Housekeeping and Judiciary come to order. Today is February 15th, 2017. First item on the agenda is a public hearing on House Bill 2622. Open public hearing.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2622 deals with financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. It allows financial institutions, including banks, credit unions, trust companies, brokers, and investment advisors, to refuse transactions when they reasonably believe that financial exploitation has occurred or they've received information from law enforcement or DHS that abuse might be occurring. The freezes can last up to 15 days if they involve the sale of a security. For non-security related transactions, the freeze can be up to 10 days, and they can be terminated by a court order or upon satisfaction to the financial institution that the exploitation is not occurring. This measure is not ready to move today.
Okay, thank you. Tim Martinez and Betsy Steinberg and Ken Sherman, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. We appreciate the committee hearing this bill early in the session, and we would look forward to talking further on the bill after the hearing. With me to my immediate right is Betsy Steinberg, who's a vice president and branch manager of Pioneer Trust Bank, a bank located here in Salem, Oregon. And to her right is Ken Sherman Jr., who is longtime counsel to the Oregon Bankers Association. And folks that have been on this committee for a while probably recognize Mr. Sherman, who's testified many times before you. Betsy was a member of the Elder Abuse Task Force that was around for a few years. I think now with both Representative Hoyle and Representative Gilliam, unfortunately not in the body, that group has not met for a while. I don't know if it's going to be reconstituted at some point, but she certainly can bring some real-world examples of what we're seeing in banks. And I do know that, and maybe Betsy will follow up on this, but I do know that Representative Gilliam did have an interest in heading down this path. The OBA has been an active participant player in preventing elder abuse for well over 20 years. In 1995, we worked with the then Attorney General to put in place a statute in this area. We've developed, I think, three times now training kits for bankers to identify elder abuse. In fact, bankers are, after family members, are the highest reporters of elder abuse in their communities. I don't want to steal Betsy and Ken's thunder, so I'm going to defer to Ken to talk a little bit about the mechanics of the bill, and then Betsy will talk a little more about her involvement and hopefully give you some examples of what we're seeing out in the community. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. We requested the introduction of this bill to give credit unions and banks and trust companies another tool to be used in combating financial exploitation of elderly persons and other vulnerable persons. We actually got the idea from a law that was enacted in Washington State, I think, several years ago, and use that as the template from which to put together this bill, which basically gives these institutions the ability to place a temporary hold on customer accounts when they suspect that there may be exploitation involved in regard to that account. Specifically, the institution would be empowered to act either on its own reasonable belief or upon information that comes from DHS or a law enforcement agency or a district attorney. And when it gets that information, it could refuse a transaction or refuse a withdrawal or disbursement from the person's account. They could prevent a change in ownership of the account or prevent a transfer of assets out of that account into the account of someone else. The bill would not require the institution to institute this hold because that would, in our opinion, generate way too many positive or false positives. There are too many cases where you might have some question about it, but looking deeper into the facts, you find that there really is nothing that that generates a reasonable suspicion. So the bill gives the institution the authority to act and would protect it against liability when it does act. When the institution institutes this temporary hold, it would require it to make a reasonable efforts to notify all of the parties to the account, except in those cases where they believe that notifying a party or parties might compromise an investigation of the potential abuse. Once this hold is placed in, is instituted, it would continue for a period of 15 days under this bill, unless that period is extended or if the institution sooner becomes convinced that there is no problem. We believe that the bill as printed needs some amendments, and we have prepared proposed amendments, which were, I think, distributed to you with my testimony. I've prepared both the amendments themselves, which are now with legislative counsel for their drafting, and also a hand-engrossed version of the bill so that you can see how the amendments would fit into the bill. First, the amendments that we proposed would narrow the scope of the bill to cover only banks and credit unions and trust companies. The original draft of the bill as it came out of LC would have included securities brokers, et cetera. There's a separate piece of legislation that you may well be aware of, Senate Bill 95, that is coming forward to deal with those folks and to deal with it, these issues in their context in a way that would not be wholly consistent with the provisions of this bill. So the simplest fix for that was just to delete those references to those folks. The second substantive amendment clarifies that the account freeze may be extended where an institution believes that exploitation may have occurred or may have been attempted. I think this is really just to fix some language that was left out of the LC draft to make it clear that the extension may be put in place whether you think the exploitation has already occurred or whether you think it will occur in the future. The last amendment is the addition of a new Section 5, and after we circulated this bill within the financial community for their comments, many of our institutions came back and said, well, you know, we have provisions in our deposit contracts that actually allow us to do most, if not all, of these things. And so we wanted Section 5 to say that nothing in this bill is designed to invalidate those provisions or prevent a bank from following through on the provisions of its contract. So with those changes, we believe that this bill will give us an important new tool in fighting financial exploitation. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Stark.
I'm sorry, Representative Greenlake. I heard you were moving, so.
You're hard to tell us apart. Does this bill include both state chartered and federal chartered banks?
Yes, it does. Representative Greenlake, thank you.
Do federal chartered banks follow the laws of the state?
Representative Greenlake, that's a very complex question. There are some laws that are preempted by the federal laws of banking, the laws that govern national banks and federal savings associations and federal credit unions, and where the national laws preempt the state, then the laws that we put on the books in Oregon do not apply. There are other cases, and this happens to be one of the cases, where this law would apply across the board.
Mr. Chair, if I just may,
please.
Perhaps you could send me a note on when when the state laws apply to federally chartered banks. I'm sure Mr. Martinez will be happy to help with that.
I'll be happy to see what I can do.
Thank you.
It might be several volumes.
A little shorter than that.
Okay.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, two questions. The first one, because I'm just now going through the amendments, trying to put it in with the bill, and sometimes that can be rather challenging on the spot. My question is really, I'll just ask plain and simple. What I worry about is there an opportunity for in this language with the amendment now that allows for a person who has the right and is doing performing a transaction they want to, that the bank would stop that in good faith, but yet it really is a responsible action by the account holder?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, I think that is a technical possibility, and it's something that we are concerned about. The banker standing across from the teller's desk, you know, is trying to assess a whole bunch of information, and it certainly is conceivable that the person acting in the moment could actually forestall or block temporarily a transaction that is perfectly legitimate. I would argue that is not going to happen very often, but when it does happen, it's probably a reasonable price to pay for the additional security of having that vigilance. And keeping in mind that the hold that is placed is a temporary hold. It's by law would be only 15 days, but it could be 15 minutes if new facts come to mind and the institution now believes there's no reasonable basis for the hold. It's designed to give flexibility, but also to allow the institution to act with a reasonable certainty that it's got the law behind it.
Another question, Mr. Please. Chair, if I may. Thank you. And you said that you chatted with folks in the banking industry, something like that. Who are some of those folks? Was it other bankers, credit unions? Who all was part of that conversation?
Well, I'm not sure that I could name specific names without reference to my
not
full
people,
file. But
I'm talking
yeah.
entities. You know,
yes. We talked to community banks. We talked to representatives of several national banks because we wanted to be sure that they were fully aware of this. And in fact, they were the ones, among the ones who said, you know, we have provisions in some of our contracts that already give us this authority. And we also talked to the credit union people. And so I think we pretty well covered the base in terms of who we need to address this with in the industry.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, Betsy might want to talk a little bit about the task force, because I know this issue was discussed at the task force, and maybe give you a little background on folks that were represented at that task force, if that would be helpful.
I could do it now. Okay, so I was part of the I'm Betsy Steinberg. I'm from Pioneer Trust Bank. I'm an assistant vice president. No, I'm a vice president now, and I'm branch manager for 20 years. I've been on the forefront of this for many, many years. And as Tim mentioned, that I have been on the Elder Financial Abuse Work Group, the Governor's Task Force, which I represented banks. There was also a representative for the credit unions. We also had law enforcement, people from DHS, prosecutors. It was a very diverse group, and we had a special task force that looked at financial abuse. It covered all forms of abuse, but we had a special task force for financial abuse. And this part of this bill actually was brought up during one of those work group sessions. It never came far enough along, you know, to make it into an actual bill for consideration. But in going out and meeting with other bankers, some of us already do this to some degree, but there's no real legal standing to do this. And I think there's a fear of repercussions by doing basically the right thing in protecting the assets. And what I've discovered in meeting with other bankers, both on the local level and internationally, or not internationally, on the national level, is now I've lost my train of thought, sorry about that, is that we're going to go ahead and pay reasonable expenses on the account. Usually it's fairly simple and plain to see that this is for housing, this is for food, this is for clothing. Buying a couch or a TV isn't necessarily a necessity, so we're going to deny those transactions. We do this already during an ongoing investigation. But again, there's a little feeling of uncertainty because there's no legal basis for us to really take this kind of an action. So this law gives us the proper framework to do this, if that makes sense.
And
So I have a question. This would apply, I would assume, or I'm asking, does it apply to online banking as well?
It would cover all forms of banking. That's correct, because there's different venues that the abuse takes place, and online banking is definitely one of the venues.
Yeah, I bet it is. Okay, thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. And I have a few questions. Okay. Would you like me to
please
request permission each time?
No, you go ahead.
All right, so I'm supportive of the concept. I'm trying to work out some of how the details would work. Who, ultimately, if someone, how would, if there was abuse assumed, or that they thought there was reasonable reasons to believe that there's abuse, then how does that person who's trying to work out the transaction that they suspect prove they're innocent? And who makes the final decision? If a hold's been put in place, who makes that final decision? Yes, this person, you know, is engaging in financial exploitation, or no, they're not.
Mm-hmm. It just depends on the circumstances. I can't tell you. There are so many variations of elder financial abuse. And in some cases, we make file a report for DHS, and it's literally a handoff. But their investigation can take weeks sometimes. So we're in this holding pattern until they come back or they get a solution in place or say, no abuse is found. That's one scenario. Another scenario is getting a family member in place. And there may have to be steps that family has to take, either competency hearings or notes from doctors, you know, following through on estate plans to get the proper person in place to take over that person's finances. Other instances might be just the amount of time it takes us to do the investigation ourselves to determine whether or not it's something that potentially is illegal. Then we would call law enforcement. And so it may be law enforcement that comes back to us and says, yes, no abuse has taken place. Or sometimes we receive notification from law enforcement or from the Department of Human Services that they believe that there's exploitation taking place. So we need to take action to protect those assets while they do their jobs. And that's really what this tool is to allow us to do, is to get whoever is going to be doing the key work on this, you know, give them time to do what they need to do.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Stark, just one final piece on that. A lot of times it also is from a family member.
Yes, family member.
Who thinks that their sibling or other family member that's responsible for taking care of the elder family member is abusing them financially.
So are you guys, the terminology of allow versus require, I understand why you would make it permissible like that. Are you concerned that that would bring back some sort of liability to you guys on a subjective decision on whether it is or isn't? And I can see two different liability potentials here. One is, for whatever reason, a 15-day hold causes some sort of transaction to not go through and some deal falls through. And then the person says, is able to demonstrate there's no abuse going on, and that, because it's a subjective decision, that then they go after you guys. That's one time. Another is, if DHS, they're not always as timely as we would like them to be, if they don't respond during that 15 days and you release the money and it was financial exploitation, how are you guys going to handle the potential liability risks of those?
Well, I can tell you of one case that we had that went on for probably 6 or 8 weeks, and it was family members pointing fingers at each other. And there were several things that caused me to do repeated reports to DHS, and so each one of those would be, in my mind, a triggering event for us to continue, for continuation of that hold, you know, while they were doing their investigation. So I don't know, again, case by case, and everything is case by case. There are circumstances that I think would probably, if I'm not mistaken, allow us to either replace that hold or do a continuation, you know, for that hold.
One last one. I think it's my last one. Thank you, Chair Barker. And one other thing, just reading the bill in its current form, I have a slight concern about is it. I don't feel like it's as clear as it, in my opinion, should be. When there's, as you said a minute ago, you place a hold when you expect that there's financial exploitation with an account. And I'm concerned that, you know, you may not, you're not clarifying who you suspect the abuse is with. And the reason I bring this up is I'm currently involved in a case where I'm power of attorney, and the bank is being fantastic. Okay, so I can see where it could go wrong, where we suspect that there is some financial exploitation happening. And the way this is written, the bank could say, well, for me, power of attorney, I can no longer be making transactions with this because there's another expected or thought of financial exploitation happening with this account, and therefore it freezes my ability to pay for other things. Like, is it freezing all things in the account, some things? one thing? That's where I'm confused on this whole.
My understanding or the intent behind this is to give us flexibility. So in that particular scenario, I had a case very much the same way where there was, I call it good child, bad child, with battling power of attorneys. And what I basically told the family, again, is I will allow you to pay reasonable expenses for the care and upkeep of that individual. That includes medical, housing, and food. And if there's any question, call me before you make the transaction, and we'll let you know, while DHS is doing the investigation, whether we can, if it's reasonable, we'll go ahead and honor that. So, does that make sense?
I just like to say at one point in my last life, other life, I was the person in charge of the fraud detail in the Portland Police, and the banks, this was in the 80s, and the banks frequently called us when they suspected wrongdoing, especially some of the fast stuff where the Jamaica Boy switch, where a guy comes in and needs $4,500 of earnest money, and they really did a great job without any mandate at all, and I really appreciate the service of the banks to the public.
Thank you.
For all the years. So, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor this. I have to admit I'm kind of stuck how this would happen. And maybe that's being naive. I'm thinking somebody has access to somebody's, the account holder's debit card. And they go out and they spend money with that debit card, and sometimes it's money for that person, and sometimes it's whatever. How does a bank tune into that? See, I just don't.
Lots of ways. We have all sorts of different methods for investigating, detecting, and deterring this type of activity. So for the instance of a debit card, we actually have fraud neural networks that detect abnormal reactions. Or I'll give another example of one that happened just 2 months ago where there was an overdraft on an account that never had overdrafts. When you review the account history, you start looking at the transactions and you say, why is she doing gaming systems? Why is she purchasing this stuff? She's in a care facility or something. So whenever we have one of those little red flags go off, we do an investigation internally to determine whether the account behavior is in keeping with the customer relationship. And that can take time. That can take months or not months. It can take days or weeks to actually go through, depending on how far back you go. So, as I said, there's a system of red flags that get triggered that would cause a bank to do an investigation and to make the determination, okay, I need to contact the customer, or I need to contact the next of kin, or I need to contact the police. And so that's, as I said, this bill would give us time to start denying those transactions, to temporarily suspend the debit card until we can verify whether those transactions are legitimate or not.
And follow up, you do that now sometimes?
Oh, yes, we do it all the time.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, I can bring any of them that would like to see a copy of our training materials. As I think I mentioned earlier, the Oregon Bankers Association is really nationally known for the training materials they put together in conjunction with DHS, as well as several different attorney generals over the last 20 years. So frontline folks in banks are highly trained in this area. As I say, bankers, financial institution employees make up the, outside of family members, the number one reporter of elder abuse. So we think we have a great product. I don't know if the chair is going to let Betsy continue with some of her testimony, but I will say she has been gone to D.C., met with AARP, met with the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, because we really think we have a very unique and successful training program here in Oregon.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Well, again, most of my testimony has already been brought out, but as he mentioned, I did participate in the AARP symposium, and Oregon is a leader in this area. I cannot convey that enough. The training materials developed by the Oregon Bankers Association is already in use by several states and is, I think, going to be the basis of training developed by AARP. At that same conference, there were other bankers represented nationally as well as law enforcement. It was kind of like a same little version, only nationally, of our work group here in Oregon. And in fact, it almost seemed like it was modeled on the work group. And again, the consensus was out of that group among the bankers is that we need a safe harbor in order to deny these transactions while we're doing a safeguard. That because of Regulation CC, which dictates how long we can place holds on on the accounts. That's a national law, that there may be some perceived conflicts in terms of what's available on the national law. I don't believe there's anything in our law that would cause any conflict with that statute, but again, it would give us the proper structure for banks to feel free to take that move. We call it a little dance, you know, where you're just, you know, really, you're not sure you're in line with federal law, but you know that it's the right thing to do to protect the assets while this is happening. So, also to kind of give a little more background to what the Oregon Bankers Association is, it's not just developing the materials or the training. They have proactively gone out in different communities and different venues to train bankers on these training materials, to go over making response plans with them within their own institution. I've actually gone out and spoken, I can't tell you, at least a dozen times to different bankers associations, specifically on elder abuse, how to protect and detect and protect your customers from elder abuse. Let's see if there's anything else. We're very fortunate in Oregon. We already have several statutes in place. I think this is just another piece of the puzzle that would strengthen our ability to do the reporting. And again, I would like to underscore, this bill will not prevent any financial institution from allowing legitimate transactions for the care and upkeep of the vulnerable person. As Ken mentioned, you know, yes, there may be a transaction that might get denied that is legitimate, but again, we feel that you know, it's worth the risk. I can't tell you how quickly they can drain an account, especially if you have somebody that is very proactive. They can, I've actually had people in the lobby screaming at me, telling me I will do this transaction, where I've had to eject them from the building. It is unbelievable the extent of what people will do, both stranger and relatives and caregivers, you know, when they are determined. And again, so for us to be able to say, I'm sorry, there's a freeze or hold on the account while, you know, and we're, while we conduct our investigation or contact the proper authorities, it would be just a huge tool for the front line in dealing with these situations. I can answer any questions more about, I could give you some more examples of cases I've had.
You've done a great job. Thank you very much, and I'll call it the next.
Mr. Chair, if I could just say one last thing.
Sure.
Apologize. Once we do get the amendments back from Legislative Council, I will be following up individually with all members of the committee to go through the changes that are being made. I was made aware of, just as the hearing started, that you are going to have some folks that object to the bill. I did have Ken Sherman talk to them, and we're going to continue to flesh out their issues. So I'll be working with them as well. The AG, we've also met with them, and they need to see the amendments. But I think if the amendments do what we believe they will do, I don't want to speak for them, but I would think they might be neutral. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yuri Byrne and Arthur Towers. And Cheryl, do you want to come up here? You go in any order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Byrne, and I've submitted some written testimony. I'm a lawyer that does investment fraud cases and elder abuse cases, and I think there's a lot in this bill that is good. I mean, the general idea of giving the banks the ability to hold up transactions when they suspect elder abuse is a good thing. However, there's a couple things that I have concerns about. One is that one of the basic ideas in the Elder Abuse Act and in Senate Bill 95 that applies to investment advisors and stockbrokers is giving notice to DHS or other authorities. And 2622 does not have a provision that requires the bank to give notice, for example, to DHS or to any regulatory authorities. So if you have a situation, I mean, oftentimes the bank will be alerted by a police department or by somebody. But sometimes the bank will suspect something on its own. And the way this is written, the only notice they have to give is to the person who's being exploited in the first place or to other people who might be on the account. And we think that the banks and the committee should strongly consider requiring that notice be given to DHS so that there can be follow-up, because oftentimes there's a lot more going on than just the particular fraud that might be evident to the bank. And that would, I think, greatly serve the purposes of the elder abuse law. And it would be, we'd like the opportunity to talk with them about why that isn't in here. And it is, like I said, in Senate Bill 95, and hopefully that will become part of that bill stay in that bill if and when it becomes law. The other concern we have, and no one seems to know how this got in the bill, but there's an exemption in the bill for trust companies from the civil liability provisions of the Elder Abuse Act. And so far as we can tell, it has nothing to do with the purpose for the bill that's been discussed today, and it's just a exemption that is the bill grants to trust companies. There are other exemptions in the Elder Abuse Act, but this would be a new one, and it's inconsistent, I would think, with the rest of the bill, which is to promote protection of elders, to now give an exemption to trust companies. So those are my concerns. In general, there's a lot that's good here. And it probably would be good in general to have it be consistent with any bill that comes out for broker-dealers and investment advisors, so the standards are the same. And I think some care needs to be taken with this bill and Senate Bill 95 to make sure the language tracks the definitions and the terms of the elder abuse law.
Thank you for pointing those out. And as Mr. Martinez said, he works, hopefully we get those resolved.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm proud to be the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. A number of our members work on consumer protection in the area of securities fraud and elder financial abuse. Another group of our members work in the area of elder physical abuse. And sadly, in both instances, anecdotally at least, the groups are reporting a rise in these areas. This is an area that we take very, very seriously. We want to put ourselves on the record with the similar concerns to those raised by Mr. Byrne. I don't have the opportunity to testify before you on every bill that we're concerned about. But I did want to make an appearance today because this one rose to the level where getting this squared away would be very, very important. We look forward to working with all parties to improve the bill and protect the elderly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is involved with elder abuse cases quite often in our consumer protection area. We see this, as Art mentioned, it's on the rise, and with Oregonians getting older, a vast majority of them, we're fearful that this is going to keep going on an upward trend. We also touch on this in our criminal area. Thanks to you, in 2015, we do have a elder abuse resource prosecutor, and he is busy at work. I'll just echo what's been said. We like the idea behind this bill. We particularly like that this would prevent change in ownership to a vulnerable person's account. We liked it. We saw that in the bill and like that. It sounds like there's an amendment coming, and we'll be in discussions with the Oregon Bankers Association on that as well. We did have concerns, especially in its relation to Senate Bill 95. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Vile, please.
Gary, if I understood you correctly, you're concerned about that section, subsection 7 of Section 3 that Ken Sherman's hand engrossed has now as subsection 6, the immunity provision. Is that what you were referring to a minute ago?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, I was talking about subsection 4 of the original bill. I don't have any amendments or engrossed version. and that is an amendment to the elder, to ORS 124.115, which is part of the Elder Abuse Act. And
On the page 2, line 40, 41, 42 in there.
Okay, so just above that in the original bill, there's provision that says a financial institution and all employees are immune from criminal, civil, and administrative liability for actions taken under subsection 1. Is that not a concern then?
That may be a concern, yes. But that is more a concern because right now no notice has to be given to anybody other than the person who's being exploited. So you have a situation where the bank can do what it wants to do and then has immunity no matter what it does. And I think it'd be much better if you're going to give the banks some protection, which in general could be a good idea in this kind of situation, so they can act in good faith and to protect the person. You also should have notice, though, going to some authorities who can look at what's going on rather than just involving the vulnerable person. So I guess the short answer is I would like to look at Section 7 more to make sure it's not overbroad. But
if you had notice, you're not necessarily concerned about Section 7 at this point.
I'd be less concerned about the degree of immunity, yes.
Okay.
But and also, frankly, I'd like to talk to people who do more elder abuse cases than I do and find out what they think about this kind of thing, because I'm not sure this has really been vetted very much among lawyers that do these kinds of cases. This was a surprise to me until the middle of last week.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate your information. We close the public hearing on House Bill 2622 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2623.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2623 deals with two different and very important acts, the Uniform Principal and Income Act and the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. Within the Uniform Principal and Income Act, one half of trustee or other custodial type of service fees must come from the principal of the trust and the other from the interest earned on the trust assets. House Bill 2623 would allow the trustee to determine where the appropriate source for those fees to be paid from comes from. The second half of this deals with the trustee administering trusts solely in the interest of the beneficiary and when those transactions can be voided. House Bill 2623 modifies the rules with an additional element so that beneficiaries can void transactions that occur only if they occur outside the ordinary course of the trustee's business or on terms and conditions substantially less favorable than those offered to similarly situated clients. This is also not ready to move today.
Okay. So, Mr. Martinez, I imagine you want to start with the hit.
If I may,
okay.
Mr. Chair. Tim Martinez here again on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. To my immediate right is Linda Thomas Bush, Vice President and Trust Officer for U.S. Bank. And again, to her right is Ken Sherman, longtime OBA counsel. With apologies to folks who have been on this committee a while, I start on this bill with my usual, sometimes bankers are folks that believe in belts and suspenders at the same time. And some of the stuff in this bill falls in that category. So I apologize. I also apologize to the female members on the committee. I've not been able to come up with a belts and suspenders analogy for women. If you have one, I'd be happy to include it in my testimony next time. At any rate, this we think makes two good changes to trustees and their services. I will let Mr. Sherman lay out the changes, and then Linda will kind of give some examples of real world But very briefly, what we're trying to do is in trusts where there aren't a lot of liquid assets, we want to give that the opportunity to the fees be collected without having to go into the trust assets themselves. I know Representative Vile talked to me right before the committee, so I'll brief you. He has a question, what if they want to go into the assets? So I'll be thinking of an answer to that question. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sherman, if that's okay.
Okay, Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Ken Sherman, counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. As Tim has said, we're looking at proposed changes here to Chapter 129 that deals with the allocation of income and principal in a trust, and also with Chapter 130, which is our Oregon Trust Code. So the first change simply is designed to give the trustee more flexibility in making a decision case by case as to where to draw the assets necessary to pay the compensation of the trustee and compensation that may be owed to other parties with whom the trustee is dealing. The current law says unequivocally 50% comes from income, the other 50% comes from principal. And sometimes that works perfectly, but you have cases, and I think both I and Linda can speak to examples of these, where that is not a really workable or practical formula in some cases. You may have a situation where there is you know, lots of income coming into the given the assets of the trust and the circumstances, but you've got a trust that is made up of illiquid assets, and if half of the compensation that we're talking about has to come out of those illiquid assets, then we've got to either mortgage them or we've got to sell some of them or do something in order to generate that compensation that would be paid out. You can have the other situation where you can there's assets in the trust from which you can draw the compensation, but for whatever reason the trust doesn't have any current income, so there's or not enough current income, so you've got that situation. So it's really just designed to give the trustee the flexibility. It doesn't alter the amount or the manner of determining the compensation that would be paid to any of these folks. It just deals with giving some flexibility as to how that compensation is constituted. Let's see. The second proposed amendment deals with 130.655, which is part of our Oregon Trust Code. That statute generally requires the trustee to administer trusts solely in the interests of beneficiaries, which obviously we wouldn't change. Subsection 4 of that deals with transactions between a trustee and a beneficiary, and it currently provides that a transaction that does not concern trust property, but from which the trustee obtains an advantage, will be voidable by the beneficiary if the transaction occurs during the existence of the trust or while the trustee retains significant influence over the beneficiary. This language causes something of a problem for institutional trustees, particularly, I think, in smaller communities where you've got one institution that is providing all sorts of services to its customers, including beneficiaries of the trust. This can put financial institutions in an uncomfortable position where, because of this statute, they have some trepidation about making a separate transaction, say a loan on a new home or something, with a person who happens to be the beneficiary of the trust. So what we have wanted to insert into the law by way of amendment is language that will just say that we don't have a problem if the transaction that we're talking about is in the ordinary course of the financial institution's business, such as making a loan, and that it's made on terms that are no less favorable to the beneficiary than the terms that are generally offered by that institution to third parties. And we think in that situation, then we should have that greater flexibility. So with these two changes, and I think that's the one that Tim would describe as the belt and suspenders, but we do think that would be a good addition to the trust code. With that, I'll defer to Linda Bush, who will speak to further examples.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Linda Thomas Bush. I'm a vice president and a senior trust officer for U.S. Bank, where I've been for 39 years. So I would say I have a little bit of experience in the trust world. Some of the examples on the first part of the bill with regard to fees is, for instance, I have a trust right now that the asset is timberland. When we cut timber, there is income. Otherwise, there's no income, and I have to pay out all the income. I don't have the ability to charge half the fees to principal without selling some of the timberland, which is the legacy asset in the trust. The trust was set up by a dad who was a longtime timberman. He wanted that timber to stay in trust to earn income for his family. So if it weren't for the willingness of the beneficiaries to pay to allow us to charge all of our fees to income, then we'd be in a pretty big pickle. We'd probably have to sell off pieces of land, and that wasn't the intent of the grantor. Another situation might be a family-owned business. Produces a lot of income, but you would have to sell you'd probably have to sell the entire business, because who's going to buy a portion of a business? So those are a couple of examples where it would be nice to allow the trustee to charge all fees to either income or, in Ken's example, to principal. If the beneficiaries say, no, I want you to take half of it out of principal, what I would do is I would involve an attorney, make sure all of the beneficiaries of the trust agree to the ramifications of that, and then I would have the attorney prepare an agreement that everyone would sign so that everyone understands what the issues are, what the ramifications of them asking us to do, and it would all be in writing. The second part of the bill with regard to voidable transactions under the Uniform Trust Code. An example might be I have a trust for a beneficiary, and then U.S. Bank has a big promotion and a reduced rate on an equity line. It's the best rate in town. The beneficiary would like to take out an equity line. Well, that transaction could be voidable. So we just want to avoid that and allow the beneficiaries to bank wherever they're going to get the best deals and allow the banks to not have that conflict.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2623. Open a work session on House Bill 2606.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2606 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2606 to the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Are there any questions? Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Open a work session on House Bill 2357.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2357 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2357 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions?
Can I?
Yes, you may.
Can I ask the counsel?
Sure.
I tried reading the bill. What's the main result of this bill?
Chair Barker,
I thought she
Representative Greenlake,
corporation this, entity or something, but
yes, this would allow for courts to hold limited liability corporations and other newer corporations in contempt of court, similar to how corporations have been for the last several decades.
And would that allow the courts to put somebody in prison, in jail for contempt of court?
I think so, Rep. Greenlake. Not the limited liability corporation.
Well, the Supreme Court's determined that corporations are people. But why can't corporations be put in jail for contempt of court?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake, I believe we have a bill on that.
Similar.
We made him eligible for jury duty last time, so.
We're trying to try that again. I also want him to register for the draft.
But only mail companies.
When they get to be 18.
Wouldn't have to do that. Representative Post. Companies.
I just want to note, Chair Barker, that as I said earlier during the public hearing, that I would be remiss with my theme of hating the emergency clause. It did not get amended at my request, so I just want to make sure that I'll probably say something about it on the House floor, but hoping the Senate will amend it and take it out, because I don't see an emergency. I don't see an, even an urgency.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion? Are there any questions? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Post, would you like to carry the bill?
No good deed goes unpunished.
As long as you'll deflect Representative Gomberg from me, because he's like a... Sure, why not?
Okay. And committee, on the 23rd, Thursday, we have a field trip to McLaren that will last. OYA will provide bands, and we'll leave here and, at 1 o'clock and go up to McLaren. 2 o'clock, I'm sorry, and be up at McLaren for the afternoon. If you have not been there before, I would strongly recommend you attend that, if at all possible. And if you have been there before, it's great to be good to go again. Okay. Stand adjourned.
Excellent.